free houses. Everyone is drinking from disposable cups. All the pictures have been removed from the walls, fragile objects moved, the furniture covered in plastic. Two of the juniors take turns guarding the staircase all night to stop anyone going upstairs. Say what you like about Kevin, but just like his coach, he believes in preparation and planning and doesn't leave anything to coincidence. The cleaner is coming first thing tomorrow. She gets paid well not to say anything to his parents, and on a night like this one, he knows the neighbors will go to bed with earplugs and pretend they weren't home if anyone asks. No longer does anyone question the fact that he seems to be the only person not enjoying his own party. In the living room, teenagers are drinking and singing as they shed their clothing at an ever-increasing rate. But on the other side of the thick, heavily insulated walls, the garden is almost silent. The sweat is dripping from Kevin's face as he goes on firing shot after shot after shot at the goal. He can never wind down after a match, but at least he's not so violent if they've won. If they've lost, the terrace and little rink end up littered with broken sticks and shattered glass. As usual, Benji is sitting perfectly calm at a cast-iron table, rolling cigarettes nimbly between his fingers to get the tobacco out without breaking the paper. He fills the empty tube with weed, twists the end shut, carefully puts the filter between his teeth, removes it, and replaces it with a thinly rolled piece of cardboard. He has to do it this way because the woman who owns the tobacconists in Beartown is the sister of the school's headmaster, so he can't buy loads of cigarette papers but not an equivalent quantity of tobacco without questions being asked. Ordering online would be pointless. Benji's mother checks all the mail that arrives at the house like a sniffer dog. So, even though no one has ever seen Kevin smoke, a few years ago he started to charge an admission fee of 2 cigarettes from everyone attending his parties so that Benji has something to roll his joints with. Oddly enough, Kevin finds it relaxing, watching his idiotic best friend focus so intently on his drugs. Kevin grins and says, "I'm going to sell you into child labor in Asia. Those agile fingers can stitch footballs faster than any other little kids. Do you want me to sew a bigger net for you so you can actually hit the goal every now and then?" Benji wonders, then ducks down like a shot without even looking up to avoid the puck that Kevin fires over his head. It hits the fence behind him, making it sway for several minutes. "Don't forget to roll some for the house cleaner," Kevin reminds him. Benji hasn't forgotten. This isn't the first party they've hosted. Amit walks into the house and can't help gawking. "Okay, seriously? Just one family lives here?" Bobo and Lit laugh and push him toward the kitchen. Lit is already so drunk that he couldn't put a magnet on a fridge door. They're drinking knock shots. Amit doesn't know what's in them, but they taste of moonshine and throat lozenges, and every time you down one, you have to beat your fists on each other's chests and roar, "Knock shot!" It feels a lot more logical after 5 or 6 of them. Most of the kids are doing it. "You can fuck any girl you like here tonight. They're all hockey whores when we win," Lit slurs, gesturing toward the throng of bodies inside the house. Then just a moment later, violently grabbing hold of Amit's top and bellowing, "Unless Kevin or Benji or I want her, the first line is first pick." Amit will later remember Bobo looking as uncomfortable as him when Lit says this. It's the first time he's ever seen Bobo look uncertain about anything. As Lit lurches away, shouting, "I got an assist tonight! Who wants to fuck?" The other two boys are left forlornly facing each other in the kitchen. They drink more, beat each other's chests, and yell, "Knock shots!" to avoid having to talk, because they're both convinced you can tell from a man's voice if he's a virgin. Maya and Anna are among the last to arrive at the house, because Anna insisted on stopping to check her makeup a couple of dozen times during the walkover. Every month, she becomes obsessed with a different part of her body, and right now, it's her cheekbones. Not long ago, it was her hairline. That time, she very solemnly asked Maya to help her find out if it was possible to have plastic surgery to make it lower. Before they go inside the house, Maya stops on the road to admire the view. From the street where the Erdahl family lives, you can see right across the lake, all the way to the forest on the other side. It's more of a wilderness there. The trees grow more densely, and even the snow seems to gather in deeper drifts. Beyond it lie open white spaces so vast that you could stand there as a child convinced you were the last person on the planet. Kids in Beartown soon learn that that's the place to go if you want to get up to no good out of sight of any adults. Maya knows that Anna came close to getting them both killed over there when they were little. When they were 12, she stole a snowmobile and drove Maya around all night. Maya has never admitted it, but she's never felt more liberated than she did then. A year later, Anna stopped Googling how to hotwire snowmobiles and started Googling diets instead. So Maya takes a moment now to mourn the girls who used to play on the other side of the lake before she goes into the party. Kevin is standing on the terrace and sees Maya walk into the hall through the big windows. He's looking right at her and doesn't notice Benji watching him, reading his reaction. As Kevin moves quickly toward the terrace door, Benji irritably packs his things in his backpack and follows him. They push their way through the living room without a word, toward different goals. Kevin stops in front of Maya and makes a real effort to stop the pounding of his heart being visible through his shirt, and she does her best not to show how happy she is, or how much she's enjoying the fact that a whole gaggle of older girls in the kitchen are looking over and hating her. "Madam," Kevin smiles theatrically and gives a deep bow.
"Herr von Shitmagnet, how delightful to see you,"
she laughs, bowing to him in return. Kevin opens his mouth but stops himself when he sees Benji disappear through the front door. He looks almost as disappointed as the girls in the kitchen and Anna do. Out in the street, Benji pulls his backpack onto his shoulders, shields his lighter from the wind, and waits for the smoke to curl its way into his lungs. He hears Kevin call but doesn't turn around.
"Come on, Benji, you freak! Don't be stupid!"
"I don't party with little girls, Kev. You know that. What are they, 15? Kevin throws his arms out.
"Come off it. It wasn't even me who invited them."
Benji turns around and looks his best friend in the eye. It takes almost 10 seconds before Kevin starts laughing. "Nice try." "You can't lie to me, Kev." "Stay anyway?" Kevin asks with a grin. Benji calmly shakes his head. Kevin blinks sadly.
"What are you gonna do then?"
"Have my own party." Kevin looks at the backpack.
"Don't smoke so much that you start seeing little pixies with knives and shit in the forest again, okay? I don't want to have to come looking for you because you're sitting huddled up in some fucking tree shouting and crying."
Benji bursts out laughing. "That happened once, and it wasn't weed.
Do you remember how you phoned me and screamed, 'I've forgotten how to blink'?"
"Don't joke about that. It was seriously fucking nasty." Kevin looks like he wants to touch him. He doesn't.
"And if you're gonna steal a car, don't do it on this street, okay? Dad would get seriously pissed off."
Benji nods, but doesn't make any promises. Then he pulls a joint from his pocket and tucks it gently behind Kevin's ear. "For later. With a bit of tobacco, just the way you like it." Kevin gives him a quick hug, so fleeting that no one would notice, but still so hard that it speaks volumes. He can never sleep after games, and that's the only time he smokes. Only best friends know that sort of thing about each other. Only two boys who once lay side by side under the covers, reading comics by flashlight and realizing that the reason they always felt like outsiders was because they were superheroes. As Benji walks off into the darkness, Kevin watches him go for a long time, feeling envious. He knows the girls fall for him because he's good at hockey. Without it, he'd only be an average, mediocre 17-year-old. But not Benji. They fall for him for completely different reasons. He's got something everyone wants, something completely independent of anything he does on the ice. His eyes always let you know that he could leave you any moment if he felt like it, without so much as a backward glance. He isn't tied to anything. He just doesn't care. Kevin is terrified of loneliness, but Benji embraces it as a natural state. All through their childhood, Kevin has been scared that one day he'll wake up and discover that the other superhero is gone. That this friendship never meant anything to him. Benji's blood is different from other people's. He disappears into the forest on the road down toward the lake, and Kevin can't help thinking that Benji is the only truly free individual he knows. That's the last time they see each other in their childhood. That ends tonight.
Chapter 21. Maya watches Kevin's every move when he comes back into the house. At first, he looks like a kitten that's been left out in the rain, abandoned and forgotten,
even though she's never encountered anyone who's at the center of things as much as him. Then he downs two drinks out in the kitchen and roars, "Knock shots!" with Bobo and Amit, and jumps up and down with his arm around Lit so hard that the floor vibrates, singing, "We are the bears!" She isn't sure when he gives her the first alcoholic drink, but the second one isn't anywhere near as repulsive. He keeps making bets with Lit about who can finish their drink first, and Kevin wins every time, and Maya smiles indulgently and says, "Honestly, you hockey guys can't even drink without turning it into a competition." Kevin looks directly at her, as if they were alone, and seems to take her comment as a challenge. "Get more shots," he tells Lit. "Yes! Run, Lit! I'll time you!" Maya laughs sarcastically, clapping her hands. Lit runs straight into a wall. Kevin laughs so hard that he's left gasping for breath. Maya is fascinated by the way he always seems to be living in the moment. On the ice, he doesn't seem to think about anything but hockey, and off it, he doesn't seem to think about anything at all. He lives on instinct. She wishes she could be like that. She doesn't know how much they drink. She can remember beating Lit at drinking 3 shots in a row, then standing on a chair with her arms raised in triumph as if she were holding a giant trophy. Kevin likes the fact that she's different, that her eyes never quite stop moving, that she's always watching, that she seems to know who she is. He wishes he could be like that. Anna stops drinking after the first shot. She doesn't really know why, but Benji has disappeared, and he was the reason she wanted to come. She's standing in the kitchen with Maya, but people keep getting in between them. Anna can see the way the older girls look every time Kevin laughs at something Maya says, somewhere between derision and a death threat. She feels Lit's hands on the base of her spine and moves farther and farther into the corner. No matter how hard she sandpapers herself, how small she makes herself, she's never going to fit in here. Benji walks across the ice until he reaches the middle of the lake. He stands there smoking and watches as the town goes out, one house at a time. The hard shell beneath his feet is rocking slightly. It's late in the year to be this far out alone at night, even for Beartown. He's always liked toying with the idea of falling through and disappearing into the cold darkness beneath, even when he was a child, wondering if everything painful would cause less pain down there. Perhaps surprisingly, his dad's suicide didn't make him frightened of death, but the reverse. The only thing Benji doesn't understand is why his dad felt obliged to use a rifle. The forest, the ice, the lake, the cold. This town offers thousands of ways to die a natural death. He stands out there until the smoke and sub-zero temperature have numbed him inside and out. Then he walks back to the town, heads into one of the smaller residential areas, and steals a moped. He rides off toward Head. "Why don't you like hockey players?" Kevin asks. "You're not particularly smart," Maya laughs. "What do you mean by that?" He seems genuinely interested. "You discovered the jockstrap 70 years before you invented the helmet," she says. "We know how to prioritize," he says with a big smile. They drink some more. When they have bets, he wins. He never loses. The barn is a poor name for a bar, possibly all the more so if it is actually in a barn. But as Katya's boss usually puts it, no one has ever looked at anyone in Head and said, "You know what, you've almost got too much imagination." A band is playing on the stage in front of a handful of spectacularly uninterested men in varying stages of middle age and intoxication. Katya is standing at the bar when the bouncer comes over to her. "Does your brother own a moped?" "No," the bouncer chuckles. "In that case, I'll tell him to park it around the back." Katya, the second eldest big sister of the little brother who is bound to be the death of them all one day, merely sighs when Benji walks in. She doesn't know if he goes looking for trouble or if it seeks him out. She just knows that you never find one without the other. Lucky for him that his eldest sister isn't here, she thinks, because she'd have broken his neck by now. But Katya can't be angry, not with him. She's never been able to. "Calm down, I'm gonna take the moped back," Benji promises, and tries to smile even though she can see he's in a foul mood.
I heard you won today. What are you doing here? His sister asks.
I'm celebrating. You can see that, he replies bitterly. And she leans forward and kisses the top of his head hard.
Did you go to see Dad?
He nods. Her beloved little brother. She can see why all the girls fall for him.
Sad eyes, wild heart, nothing but trouble lies ahead for that sort, their mother says, and she knows from experience.
Katya has never been to their father's grave, not once, but she thinks of him sometimes, and how it must have felt to be so unhappy and not be able to tell anyone. It's a terrible thing to have to keep a big secret from the people you love. When Benji is angry with something, he shows up at his youngest older sister, Gabby's, and plays with her children until he gets over it. When he wants to be quiet and think, he goes to see his eldest sister, Audrey, over at her kennels. But when he's feeling bruised, he comes here, to Katya. So she pats his cheek gently instead of yelling at him.
If you can watch the bar for a bit, I can sort things out in the office. Then you can come back to my place with me.
The guys will sort out the moped thing, she says, nodding toward the bouncers. First thing tomorrow morning, two men you really wouldn't want to get into an argument with will return the moped to its owner, explaining to him that he must have left it in ahead by mistake. When it gets taken to the garage to be repaired, the garage will do the work free of charge. That's pretty much all anyone needs to know around here.
And don't touch the damn beer, Katya orders.
Benji goes around the bar and waits until his sister has gone into the office before opening a bottle of beer. The band on stage are playing covers of old rock songs, because that's what you have to play if you want to play in head. They look the way you'd expect, overweight and under-talented and distinctly average. All but the bass player. There's nothing average about him at all. Black hair, black clothes, but he still stands out. The others are giving it their all, but he looks like he's just playing. He's standing there, squeezed into 1.5 square yards between an amp and a cigarette machine, but he's dancing in his own little kingdom. As if this barn weren't at the end of the world, but at its beginning. The bass player notices the young bartender with the messy hair in the silence between two songs. And at that moment, the rest of the room might as well have been empty. Anna comes out from the bathroom. Lit is standing right outside the door. He leans his bulky frame toward her and tries to bundle the two of them back through the doorway. If he weren't already drunk, he might have succeeded, but Anna slips nimbly out of the way and darts out into the hall as he grasps for the sink to keep himself upright.
Come on, fuck it, I got an assist today. Don't I get anything for that?
Anna backs away, glancing instinctively to her right and her left along the narrow hallway, like an animal in the forest evaluating escape routes. Lit holds his arms out and slurs heavily.
I saw the way you looked at Benji. That's fine, but he won't be coming back here tonight. He's a pothead, right? So he won't be back on this planet tonight. So forget about him and focus on me instead. I got a fucking fucking assist tonight, and we won!
Anna slams the door in his face and runs toward the kitchen looking for Maya. She can't see her anywhere. Benji is pouring beer at the bar. The band has stopped playing. Katya's put some country music on instead. Benji turns toward the next customer so quickly that he almost hits him in the face with a glass. The bass player smiles. Benji raises his eyebrows.
Wow, a musician in my bar. What would you like? It's on the house.
The bass player tilts his head.
Whiskey sour?
Benji's grin stretches from ear to ear.
And where the hell do you think you are? Hollywood? You can have a JD and Coke.
He mixes the drink as he talks and slides the glass across the bar with a practiced hand. The bassist gives it a long stare without touching it, then admits,
Sorry, I don't even like whiskey. I was just trying to sound like a rocker.
Whiskey sour isn't all that fucking rock and roll, Benji informs him. The bass player runs his hand through his hair.
I met a bartender once who said that if you stand on that side of the bar long enough, you start to see everyone as a type of drink. Like some warped version of that spirit animal thing fortune tellers go on about. Know what I mean?
Benji laughs out loud. He doesn't often do that.
Well, your spirit animal isn't whiskey, I can tell you that much.
The bassist nods and leans forward discreetly.
I'm actually more interested in something veiled in smoke than drowned in coke. I heard from someone that you might be able to help me with that. Benji downs the bass player's drink and nods. What did you have in mind? Amit and Bobo never actually decide to go out into the garden. It just happens. They're both bad at parties. They don't know what to do, so it's natural that they should seek out something that they do understand. Something they know how to do. So they end up standing in the garden, each clutching one of Kevin's sticks and taking turns firing pucks at the goal.
How do you get to be so fast? Bobo asks drunkenly.
You spend a lot of time running away from people like you at school, Amit replies, half joking and half serious. Bobo laughs, half properly and half not. Amit notes that he shoots harder than you might think when he can stand still and calmly take aim.
Sorry, you know it's just a joke, don't you? You know, it's a thing. The A-team shit on us and we shit on you.
Yeah, just a joke, Amit lies. Bobo shoots harder, full of guilt.
You're in the first line now. You get to throw my clothes in the shower from now on, not the other way around.
Amit shakes his head. You smell far too bad for me to want to touch your clothes, Bobo.
Bobo's laughter echoes between the houses, genuine now. Amit smiles at him. Bobo suddenly lowers his voice.
I need to get quicker before autumn, or I won't be allowed to play anymore.
This is Bobo's last season before he gets too old for the junior team. In other towns, there are junior teams that go up to 21, but not in Bear Town, where there aren't enough young men left in town after they graduate from high school. Some move away for school, others for work. The best players move up to the seniors, the rest get left over.
But then there's the A-team,
Amit says brightly. But Bobo lets out a dry snort.
I'll never make the A-team. This is my last season if I don't get faster. Then there's just repairing cars with Dad for the rest of my life.
Amit doesn't say anything more. He doesn't need to. Everyone who's played hockey for as much as 5 minutes as a child knows that there's no better sport. No greater rush. Amit takes a deep breath and says something he will never admit to anyone else. I was frightened today, Bobo. I was terrified the whole way through the game. I wasn't even happy when we won, just relieved. Shit, do you remember when you were little and used to play out on the lake? That was nothing but fun. You didn't even think, it was just the only thing you wanted to do. It's still the only thing I want to do. I have no idea what I'm going to do if I can't do this. Hockey's the only thing I'm any good at. But now, it just feels like
work, Bobo concludes without even looking at him.
Amit nods. I was scared the whole time.
Does that sound sick?
Bobo shakes his head. They don't say any more about it. They just fire their pucks without speaking.
Bang. 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 Bang.
Bobo nods and grins. They're 15 and 17 years old, and in 10 years' time they'll remember this evening, when all the others were inside having a party, and they stood out here and became friends. The night is clear and full of stars, the trees are still, and they're standing behind the barn, smoking. Benji never usually gets high with strangers, because most of the time it's an intimate and solitary act for him, and he doesn't really know why tonight should be an exception. The way the bass player made his own space on the stage, maybe. Like he was in some other dimension. Benji recognized it, or longed for it.
What have you done to your face? The bass player asks, pointing at the scar on his chin.
Hockey, Benji replies.
So you're a fighter?
His accent betrays the fact that he's not from this part of the country. The question reveals that it's probably his first visit.
If that's what you want to know, you shouldn't look for scars on people's faces. You should be looking for scars on their knuckles, Benji replies.
The bassist takes some deep drags, blows his bangs from his eyes.
Of all the sports I don't understand why anyone would play, hockey is the one I understand least.
Benji snorts.
Isn't the bass what people who can't play the guitar play?
The bass player laughs loudly,
and the sound sings between the trees and hits Benji in his head as quickly as in his chest. Very few people have that effect. Very few people are tequila and champagne at the same time.
Have you always lived here in Head? Don't you get cabin fever in a town this small?
The bassist smiles. His gaze alternates between shy and greedy as it roams across Benji's lips. Benji lets the smoke filter up over his cheeks.
I live in Beartown. Head is big in comparison.
What are you doing here? The bassist shrugs his shoulders, tries to sound nonchalant, but all the hurt inside him shines out.
My cousin sings in the band. Their bass player went off to college somewhere, and they asked if I wanted to move here and play for a couple of months. They're really shit, and we get, like, a crate of beer in return for playing, but I was in a bad relationship. I needed to get away.
It's hard to get any farther than this, Benji says.
The bass player listens to the trees, feels tentative snowflakes land on his hands. His voice trembles in the darkness.
It's more beautiful than I thought. Here.
Benji goes on smoking with his eyes closed. He wishes he'd smoked some more. Or was drunk. Maybe then he would have dared. But now he just says, "Not like where you're from."
The bass player inhales Benji's smoke, nods down toward the ground.
"We'll be playing here again next Sunday, if you want to come. It would be... I'd like to get to know someone... here."
His black clothes fall gently over his thin frame. His movements are soft and light, so free from exertion that he seems weightless. In a forest full of predators, he stands above the covering of snow like some sort of bird. His breath is cold as it reaches Benji's skin. Benji extinguishes the glow in his hand and takes two steps back.
I need to go in before my sister sees me standing out here. Big, tough hockey player, but you're scared of your sister? The bass player smiles.
Benji shrugs his shoulders lightly.
You would be too. Who the hell do you think taught me to fight?
See you next Sunday, then?
The bass player calls. He doesn't get an answer. Maya is standing in the kitchen when she suddenly realizes that Anna is gone. She goes to look for her. The guys see her leaning against the wall to keep her balance as the alcohol tosses her around inside, like a penguin on an unsteady piece of ice. Lit leans closer to Kevin's ear and whispers,
"The GM's daughter, Kev! Christ, you'll never get to fuck her!"
"Wanna bet?" Kevin grins.
"100 kroner.
Lit nods. They shake on it. Afterward, Maya will remember bizarre details, like the fact that Kevin had spilled a drink on his shirt and the stain looked like a butterfly. No one will want to hear her talk about that. The only thing they'll ask about that night is how much she'd had to drink. If she was drunk. If she held his hand. Gave him signals. If she went upstairs voluntarily.
"Lost?" he smiles when he finds her beside the stairs. By that point, she's been around the ground floor 3 times without finding the bathroom. She laughs and throws her arms out, forgets Anna.
"This is a completely crazy house. It's like you live in Hogwarts."
"Do you want to see upstairs?" he asks.
She'll never stop wishing that she hadn't gone with him up the stairs. Katya's car starts reluctantly on the 8th or 9th attempt. "You can sleep over at the kennels with Audrey tonight."
"No, drive me home," Benji says sleepily.
She pats him on the cheek.
"No, because you see, sweetie, Audrey and I love our little brother. And if you go home to Mom smelling of beer and weed one more time, we won't have a little brother anymore."
He grunts and shrugs his jacket off and makes a pillow out of it against the window. She pokes him on his arm, just below the sleeve of his t-shirt where the tattoo of the bear peeps out, and says,
"That bass player was sweet. But I suppose you're going to tell me he isn't your type, the way you do about everyone?"
Benji replies with his eyes closed.
"He didn't like hockey."
She laughs at that, but as her little brother falls asleep, Katya blinks away tears. Throughout his childhood, ever since the sandboxes and swings, she has seen girls look at him. As much because they dream of being able to rein him in as because they suspect it wouldn't be possible. But they never understand why. With each passing year, as Benji has grown older, Katya has wished him a different life. In a different place, another time, maybe he would have been a different boy. Milder, more secure. But not in Beartown. Here, he is burdened with too much that no one sees. And here he has hockey. The team, the guys, Kevin. They mean everything to him, so he is everything they want him to be. And that's a terrible thing, having to keep a secret from those you love. Everyone talks about what it's like. The school nurse, the poor teacher in charge of the sex education lessons, anxious parents, moralizing television programs, the entire internet. Everyone. All your life you're told exactly what happens. Even so, no one tells you it's going to be like this. Maya is lying on her back on Kevin's bed. It's her first time smoking marijuana. It feels different from how she's imagined it, as if warmth has a flavor. The smoke seems to fly straight up into her head instead of down her throat. Kevin has posters of hockey players on the walls, trophies on all the shelves, but in one corner is an old record player. She will remember that because it doesn't fit in. "It's my dad's old one. I like the way it sounds, the way it crackles when you switch it on," he says almost apologetically. He puts some music on. She doesn't remember what, just remembers the crackle. In 10 years' time, she will hear the same crackle from a record player in the corner of a bar or in a clothing boutique on the other side of the world, and will be instantly transported back to this place, this moment. She feels the weight of his body on top of hers, and she laughs. She'll remember that. They kiss each other, and she'll get these two questions more than any other she ever gets asked in her life. Who kissed whom? Did you kiss him back? He's the one kissing her, and yes, she kisses him back. But when he forces her jeans down, she stops him. He seems to think it's a game, so she catches his hand and holds it tight. "I don't want to, not tonight. I've never," she whispers. "Of course you want to," he insists. She flares up. "Are you deaf or what? I said no." His grip on her wrists tightens, first almost imperceptibly, then to the point where it hurts. Katya turns the car onto the little road that leads up into the forest just after the "Welcome to Beartown" sign, drives toward the kennels. There are no lights out here, so when Benji wakes up and looks out through the window, he doesn't realize what it is before they've already gone past. "Stop," he mutters. "What?" Katya replies. "Stop!" Benji shouts. Shocked, she breaks hard. Her little brother has already opened the door and run out into the darkness. Everyone talks about what it's like. All your life you're told exactly what happens. You get assaulted on a jogging trail, beaten and dragged into an alleyway on a package holiday, drugged in a bar and locked up by unknown adult men in a slum in a big city. Everyone warns you time and time again. They warn all girls. This can happen. This is how it happens. It's just that no one tells you it can be like this, with someone you know, trust, have laughed with. In this boy's room, beneath the posters of hockey players, with the entire floor below full of classmates. Kevin kisses her neck, moves her hand out of the way. She will remember the way he touched her body as if it didn't belong to her, as if it were a thing he had earned, as if her head and the rest were two separate objects independent of each other. No one will ask her about that. They'll just ask how much resistance she put up, if she was clear enough. "Stop playing hard to get. You came upstairs with me, didn't you?" he laughs. She tries to pull his hand away, but he's infinitely stronger than her. She tries to twist out of his grip and get up from the bed, but his knee is locked around her waist. "Stop it, Kevin, I don't want..." his breathing echoes in her ear. I'll be careful, I promise. I thought you liked me.
I do, but I've never... Stop it, please.
She tries so desperately to move his hand that her nails tear two deep scratches in his skin. She will remember seeing drops of blood seep out. Slowly, 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 and the way he doesn't even seem to notice. He is holding her down with his weight alone. He doesn't even have to put any effort into it. And his tone changes instantly. Come on, for fuck's sake, stop playing hard to get. I can go downstairs and get whatever girl I want and fuck her instead. With a last effort, Maya manages to pull one hand free and hits him as hard as she can across the cheek.
Go on then, do that, and let go of me!
He doesn't let go. His eyes just turn black. It's as if he's no longer in there anymore, the guy she had spent all evening joking around with. When she tries to stop his hand, he closes his other fist tightly around her throat like a vise. And when she tries to scream, his fingers are covering her lips. Lack of oxygen makes her slip in and out of consciousness. And in the midst of everything, she will remember peculiar details that no one asks about. A button coming off her blouse when he tears it open, and the fact that she hears it land and bounce across the floor somewhere in the room. And she will remember thinking, how am I going to find that later? They will ask her about the alcohol and marijuana. They won't ask about the bottomless terror that will never leave her. About this room with its record player and posters, from which she will never really escape again. One blouse button somewhere on the floor, and a sense of panic that will be with her forever. She sobs noiselessly beneath his body, and screams silently behind his hand. For the perpetrator, rape lasts just a matter of minutes. For the victim, it never stops. Chapter 22. It's Saturday night, and everything is different now. Anna just doesn't know it yet. All she knows is that the older girls in the kitchen laugh at her cruelly when she asks after Maya. That little whore? She went off with Kevin. Don't worry, sweetie, he'll throw her back when he's finished with her. No one on the team holds on to second-rate bitches. Their laughter tears holes in Anna's lungs and her throat tightens. Granted, she could have gone off to look for her best friend, and stands there with her phone in her hand for several minutes without actually calling. But anger gets the better of her. Few disappointments can compare with the way you feel the first time your best friend dumps you for a boy. And there's no more silent walk than the one that takes you home alone after a party when you're 15 years old. Anna and Maya found each other as children when they saved each other's lives. One pulled the other out of a hole in the ice, and in return she pulled the other out of her loneliness. They were opposites in many ways, but they both liked dancing badly, singing loud, and going fast on snowmobiles. That goes a long way. Best friends. Sisters before misters. And of all the things they've promised each other, the most important, we never desert each other. The girls in the kitchen are still laughing at Anna. They're saying something about her clothes and her body, but she's no longer listening. She's already heard it all in the school corridors and in comments online. Lit staggers around a corner and catches sight of her, and Anna mutters, "Fuck off." Because they all can. The whole lot of them. As she walks out of the front door, she stops one last time and considers calling Maya. Maybe going upstairs to look for her. But she's not going to beg and plead for attention. Even in a town that's covered with snow 3/4 of the year, it's unbearably cold standing in the shade of someone who's a bit more popular than you are. Anna puts her phone on silent and drops it in her bag. Humanity has many shortcomings, but none is stronger than pride. She sees Ahmet and grabs hold of his shoulder. He's so drunk he couldn't even read the top line of an optician's chart. Anna sighs. If you see Maya, tell her I couldn't be bothered to wait for her to decide if she likes peanuts or not. Ahmet stammers at her in confusion. Who? Anna rolls her eyes. Maya. Tell her I've gone. Where is she? The question makes his brain clearer, his voice more sober. Anna almost feels sorry for him.
Oh, Amit, don't you get it? Try looking in Kevin's bedroom.
Amit shatters into 1,000 invisible pieces. But Anna doesn't feel like staying, doesn't want to be in this house when she herself falls apart. She slams the front door behind her and the night cold strokes her cheeks. Her breathing becomes easier immediately. Her heartbeat calms. She grew up outside, and being stuck behind windows has always felt like being imprisoned. Social relationships, trying to make friends, be accepted, always starving and sandpapering herself smaller, it makes her feel claustrophobic. She takes the path through the forest in the darkness and feels infinitely safer there than in a house full of people. Nature has never done her any harm. Behind a closed door on the upper floor of the Erdahl family house stays the only secret Maya has ever kept from her best friend. That right up to the last moment, when she could no longer breathe beneath Kevin, she kept telling herself one single thing. I mustn't be frightened. Anna will find me. Anna won't desert me. Amit will never be able to explain his reasons. Jealousy, maybe. Pride, probably. An inferiority complex, possibly. Infatuation, definitely. There are two juniors sitting guarding the stairs, and when they tell him he can't go upstairs, he roars at them, surprising not just them, but himself. And which fucking line do you play in? During all those years in Little League and the boys' team, people kept saying his feet were superior, but that wasn't what took him all the way. It was the way he saw things. His eyes were always faster than everyone else's. He managed to see more than everyone else, remembered every detail of every attack. The position of the backs, the movements of the goalie, the tiniest shift in the corner of his eye when a teammate put his stick on the ice. Intimidated, the juniors get out of the way. There are three sections to the staircase. On the upstairs landing, there are photographs of the entire Erdahl family, and beside them, pictures of Kevin alone. Pictures of him everywhere. In hockey gear when he was 5, when he was 6, when he was 7. The same smile every year, the same look in his eyes. They will ask Amit exactly what he heard, exactly where he was. He will never be able to say if it was a no or a stop, or just a desperate, muffled scream from behind the palm of a hand that made him react. Maybe none of those. Maybe he opened the door out of sheer instinct. They will ask him if he was drunk. They will glower at him accusingly and say, "But is it not the case that you are, and have been for many years, in love with the girl in question?" The only thing Amit will be able to reply to that is that his way of seeing was superior. Faster than his feet, even. He pushes the door handle down and stands in the doorway to Kevin's room and sees the violence and torn clothes. The tears and the fiery red marks left by the boy's fingers on the girl's neck. One body taking the other against its will. He sees everything. And afterward he will dream about the most peculiar details. Exactly which posters of exactly which NHL players were on the walls. Amit will remember that for the simplest possible reason. He has the same posters on the wall above his own bed. Kevin loses his concentration for 2 seconds when Amit rushes through the door. That's twice as much time as Maya needs. She won't remember it as a reaction, but as a fight to the death. A survival instinct. She manages to knee Kevin hard enough to get a tiny gap in which to push his body out of hers. She hits him as hard as she can in the neck and runs. She doesn't know how she gets out of the room, who she passes on the way, if she hits or kicks the juniors guarding the stairs. Perhaps everyone at the party is too drunk to notice her. Perhaps they only pretend not to see. She tumbles out through the door and just runs. The year is halfway into March. But the snow still embraces her feet as she marches along the side of the road in the darkness. Her tears are hot when they leave her eyelids, but already frozen by the time they fall from her chin. "You can't live in this town. You can only survive it," as her mom says. Never has that been more true than tonight. Maya tugs her jacket tighter around herself. She'll never know how she managed to take it with her. Her blouse is torn to shreds, the skin on her neck and wrists already black with finger-shaped bruises. She hears Ahmet's voice behind her, but doesn't slow down. The boy stumbles a few last breathless steps in the snow before falling to his knees in it. He's drunk and crushed as he calls her name. In the end, she stops, turns with her fists clenched, and stares at him, her tears now caused by equal parts exposure and fury. "What happened?" Ahmet whispers. "What the hell do you think happened?" she replies. "We need to... you need to..." "What? What do I need to do, Ahmet? What the hell do I need to do?" "Talk to someone, the police, anyone, you need to..." "It won't make any difference, Ahmet. It won't make any difference what I say, because no one will believe me anyway."
"Why not?"
She rubs the back of her glove across her eyes, and it comes away stained with eyeliner. Ahmet is crying too now. They are 15 years old, and the entire world has collapsed in the course of a single evening. A solitary car passes them. Maya's eyes flare with the reflection of the headlights. When it's gone past, something goes out inside both her and her eyes.
"Because this is a fucking hockey town," she whispers.
Ahmet is left kneeling in the snow as she disappears down the road. The last thing he sees before night swallows her is her silhouette against the sign that says, "Welcome to Beartown." Soon she won't be anymore. Anna opens the door to the house. It swings open without a sound on freshly oiled hinges. Her dad is asleep. Her mom no longer lives here. She walks through the kitchen toward the storeroom. The hunting dogs greet her with cold noses and warm hearts. She does what she has done 1,000 times in her childhood when the house stank of alcohol and her parents were screaming at each other. She sleeps with the animals, because the animals have never done her any harm. For people who have never lived where darkness and cold are the norm, where anything else is the exception, it is hard to understand that it is possible to find someone who has frozen to death with their jacket open, or even naked. But when you get really cold, your blood vessels contract, and your heart does all it can to stop blood reaching the frozen parts of your body and then coming back to your heart cold. Not unlike a hockey team suffering a penalty and playing at a numerical disadvantage. Prioritize resources, play defensively, defend the heart, lungs, and brain. What happens when the defense finally collapses, when you get cold enough, is that your box play falls apart, your goalie does something stupid, your backs stop communicating with each other, and the body parts that were previously shut off from circulation are suddenly switched back on again. And then, when warm blood from your heart flows back to your frozen feet and hands, you experience an intense rush of heat. That's why you suddenly imagine that you're overheating and start to take your clothes off. Then the chilled blood goes back to your heart, and it's all over. Every couple of years or so, someone in Beartown goes home drunk after a party and takes a shortcut across the ice, or gets lost in the forest, or sits down to rest for a moment, and is found lifeless in a snowdrift the following morning. When Maya was little, she often used to think how strange it was that her mom and dad, the two most overprotective parents in the universe, chose to settle here, of all places. Somewhere where even nature itself tried to murder their daughter every day. As she's gotten older, she's come to realize that the admonitions, "Don't go out on the ice alone," and "Don't go into the forest on your own," are almost designed to promote team sports. Every child in Beartown grows up with the constant warning that the threat of death is ever present if you're alone. She tries calling Anna, but gets no answer. She can't force herself to walk down the main street through town, so she wraps her jacket more tightly around herself and takes the narrow road through the forest instead. When the car drives past her in the darkness and stops abruptly 50 yards ahead of her, panic hits her with full force. The adrenaline in her body reacts instantly, convincing her that someone is about to run up and grab her and do it to her all over again. One of the many things snatched from the girl that night is the place where she never needed to feel afraid. Everyone has a place like that, until it gets taken away from us. You never get it back again. Maya will feel afraid everywhere, from now on. Benji sees her through the car window with newly woken eyes. No one walks this way of their own volition at night, and he can see that she's limping. He makes Katya stop and is out in the darkness before the car comes to a halt. Maya is hiding behind a tree. You can't do that for more than a minute or so in sub-zero temperatures. The cold forces you to move about in order to keep your circulation going, whether you want to or not. Benji has been hunting in these forests with his sisters since he was big enough to hold a rifle, so he sees her. Maya knows he's seen her. Katya calls from the car, but to Maya's surprise, Benji shouts back, "It's nothing, sis. Sorry, I thought I saw... Oh, I've probably just smoked too much." Maya looks directly at him then. He's standing 10 yards away. Her tears are freezing at the same rate as his. But he merely gives a curt nod to the darkness, then turns around and disappears. He knows too much about how it feels to have to hide, to give away someone else doing the same. As the red taillights of the car fade into the night, Maya stays where she is, with her forehead against the tree trunk, sobbing hysterically without making a sound, with no tears. There are thousands of ways to die in Beartown, especially on the inside. Chapter 23. Peter and Kira wake up happy, laughing. That's what they will remember about this day, and they will hate themselves for it. The very worst events in life have that effect on a family. We always remember, more sharply than anything else, the last happy moment before everything fell apart. The second before the crash. The ice cream at the gas station just before the accident. The last swim on holiday before we came home and received the diagnosis. Our memories always force us back to those very best moments, night after night, prompting the questions, could I have done anything differently? Why did I just go around being happy? If only I'd known what was going to happen, could I have stopped it? Everyone has 1,000 wishes before a tragedy, but just one afterward. When a child is born, its parents dream of it being as unique as possible, until it gets ill, when suddenly all they want is for everything to be normal. For several years after Isak died, Kira and Peter felt a terrible, lacerating guilt every time they laughed. Shame can still catch them when they feel happy, making them wonder if it's a betrayal of their child that they didn't disintegrate entirely when he left them. One of all the terrible effects of grief is that we interpret its absence as egotism. It's impossible to explain what you have to do in order to carry on after a funeral, how to put the pieces of a family back together again, how to live with the jagged edges. So what do you end up asking for? You ask for a good day. One single good day. A few hours of amnesia. So today, the morning after a hockey game, Peter and Kira wake up happy, laughing. He whistles as he potters about in the kitchen. When she gets out of the shower, they kiss each other the way adults do when they forget that they're parents. Leo, 12 years old, runs from the table in disgust. His mom and dad laugh into each other's mouths. One single good day. Maya hears them from her room. She's lying deeply cocooned under the covers. They haven't even discovered that she's home yet. They think she spent the night at Anna's. When they open the door and look surprised, she will explain that she isn't well. She's wearing 2 pairs of jogging clothes to make sure her forehead feels warm enough. She can't tell her parents the truth. She hasn't got the heart to do that to them. She knows they wouldn't survive. She's not thinking like someone who's been the victim of a crime. She's thinking like someone who's committed one. All she can think is that no one must ever know, that she must get rid of all the evidence. So when her dad drives Leo to practice and her mom goes to the supermarket, Maya creeps out of bed and washes the clothes she was wearing yesterday, so that no one will see the stains. She will put her shredded blouse in a plastic bag and walk toward the door. But there she will stop, and she will stand there in the doorway shaking with terror, unable to bring herself to walk to the garbage bin. 1,000 wishes yesterday. One single one today. Benji's three sisters have always communicated in different ways. His youngest sister, Gabby, talks, and his middle sister, Katya, listens. His eldest sister, Audrey, shouts. If you have three younger siblings when your dad goes out into the forest with a rifle, you grow up faster than you should, and maybe become harder than you would really like to be. Audrey doesn't let Benji sleep off his hangover and forces him to get up and help her with the dogs all morning. When that's done, she drags him over to the outbuilding that's been fitted out as a small gym and makes him pump weights until he throws up. He doesn't complain. He never does. Audrey could lift more than him until a couple of years ago, but when he passed her, he did so at astonishing speed. She's seen him take down three fully grown men over at the barn when they've said something inappropriate to Katya. The sisters often talk about it when he isn't there, the things they see in their little brother's eyes when he gets really angry. Their mom always says that she doesn't know what would have happened to the boy if he hadn't found hockey, but his sisters know all too well what would have happened. They see men like that, in the barn, and at the gym, and in 1,000 other places. Hockey gave Benji a context, a structure, rules. But above all, it rewarded the best sides of him, his boundless heart and unshakable loyalty. It provided a focus for his energy, channeling it into something constructive. All through his childhood, he used to sleep with his hockey stick beside him, and sometimes Audrey is pretty sure he still does. When her little brother lets go of the bar and rolls off the bench to throw up for the third time, she hands him a bottle of water and sits down on a stool next to him. So, what's the problem? I'm just hungover, he groans. His phone rings. It's been doing that all day, but he refuses to answer it. No, not the problem with your stomach, you donkey. What's the problem up here? She sighs and points to his temple. He wipes his mouth with the back of his hand and drinks small sips of water. Oh, just a thing. With Kev. Argument? Sort of. So? Just crap. His phone goes on ringing. Audrey shrugs and lies back on the bench. Benji stands behind her and spots her as she lifts the bar. He has always wished she could have played hockey longer. She would have beaten the shit out of the whole junior team. She played for the girls' team in Head for a few years when she was young, until driving there and back several evenings a week got too much for their mother. There was no girls' team in Beartown, never has been. Sometimes Benji wonders how good his sister could have been. She gets the game. She yells at him for making the same sort of tactical mistakes that David tells him off for. And she loves it. The way her brother loves it. When she's done, she pats him on the cheek and says, "You hockey boys are like dogs. To do something stupid, all you need is the opportunity. To do something good, all you need is a reason." "So?" he mutters. She smiles and points at his phone. "So stop being such an old woman, little brother, and go and talk to Kevin. Because if I have to listen to that ringtone one more time, I'm going to drop the bar on your face." Amit calls Maya's number 10 times. 100 times. She's not answering. He can still see every detail. Thinks about it so intently that he starts trying to convince himself that he might have imagined it all. A misunderstanding. God, how wonderful that would be. If everything he thought he'd seen hadn't happened. He was drunk, after all. Jealous. He calls Maya's number over and over again. Doesn't leave any messages on voicemail. Sends no texts. He goes out running in the forest until he's too tired to think. Running all day so he can collapse with exhaustion that evening. Kevin is standing in the garden. All hockey players are used to playing through pain. There's always some little injury somewhere. A groin strain, a sprain, a fractured finger. Not a week passes in the junior team without someone talking about how they can't wait until they're old enough to play without a grill on their helmet. "Get rid of the shopping cart," they plead. Even though they've all seen A-team players who've been hit in the face with pucks and sticks, they're not afraid of it but are actively looking forward to it. When they were small, they all saw a player standing after a game with 20 stitches in his lip from splitting his cheek open. But when asked, "Doesn't it hurt?" he merely grinned and said, "Can't pretend it doesn't sting a bit when I chew tobacco." It's Sunday afternoon, and the Erdahl house, empty and silent, has been cleaned to perfection. Kevin is standing in the garden, firing puck after puck after puck. Even in Little League, he learned to play through any pain.